accession number 27185, reel 33.
When was it learned that you were going to the Middle East Staff College at Haifa rather than to the Staff College at Camberley?
That wasn't until I got my posting. In fact, I didn't know I was going to any Staff College at all until I got the posting. I mean, I knew I'd been put in for it, but as I said earlier, I'd never had the slightest idea that I'd ever go.
But were you surprised that you were going to Haifa rather than to Camberley?
I can't remember my reaction. I just think I took it as one of those things. One, you know, you're going to Haifa. Very good, sir. I don't think I worried too much about it. You know, I was glad and very grateful that I was going to be able to go to the Staff College, because it meant a lot to. Although I was still hadn't got my regular commission yet. Obviously, this is a. Something which you would need to get under your belt and have PSC under, after your name, if you're going to get make a career of the army as a regular soldier. So
certainly a step in the right direction.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, only 10% in those days of officers went to the Staff College, and if you hadn't been to Staff College, you weren't in the in line for staff jobs or the general staff or anything to do with operations or anything like that. So it was very necessary if you wanted to get on. So I don't think I minded, as long as I went.
What happened when you arrived in the Middle East? Where did you go first?
Well, we disembarked in Port Said, where for the first time I saw all the bum boats round about. They were all selling their wares. We then got on a train and went to Cairo. One thing that struck me about going on the train, because the weather was so pleasant after the horrors of northwest Europe, when winter and rain, even in England, it was one very good. And it was lovely, the mild weather, the sun was shining and warm. And I've gone off the track a bit.
You're saying about going on the train from...
That's right, yes. Going on the train, every time it stopped anywhere, it didn't matter if it was the middle of the desert or wherever we were, an Arab would materialise shouting out, "Eggs or bread?" And I don't know where they came from. I mean, you'd stop in the desert, you'd look out of the window, and you could see for miles nobody. 10 minutes later, they were outside your carriage window saying, "Eggs or bread?" But they got us all little tiny hard-boiled eggs and a piece of bread. Now and again, sort of one of the troops would throw down a couple of akkas and take them in, but I never did. But it always a mystery to me as to where they came from. Anyway, we went down to Cairo, and then we were put into barracks there. Kaiser El Neil?
Kaiser El Neil.
I think it was. The old barracks.
Was it a cavalry barracks?
I don't know. There weren't any horses there. Mm. I couldn't tell. Mm. But we were in there for at least a couple of days, I'd say 2 or 3 days, really. I remember we arrived in the evening, and we went into the mess. It was getting dark. And we were served with a great big plate of eggs, fried eggs. Seemed to be... And they had some toast. I think the first British people to appear in these parts of the world asked for eggs and toast, and they've been served up ever since to anybody who looked as they came from England. Anyway, we stayed there. We had Egyptian servants, I remember, who didn't have anything on their feet, so you didn't know where they were, whether they were coming or going. But they sort of glided about silently about on the stone floors. But I'm sure they were honest. Went out into the town and was absolutely staggered by the crowds there, all shouting, gesticulating, trams with heaps of people on them, in on the roof. I paid a visit to Shepherd's, famous Shepherd's Hotel. That's before it was burnt down in the original. I remember it was rather like going into a cathedral. It was huge inside, with sort of stained glass windows and fairly sort of darkish, cool and absolutely quiet. And obviously it had been used as an oasis for Europeans and Brits over the years to get away from the clamour outside, I think. But a most impressive place. Anyway, after we'd been there for about 2 or 3 days, we then got another train which took us up to Haifa. More eggs of bread on the way. We finished in Haifa. I think we must have been met by army transport and taken up to the staff college. Now, staff college was in a hotel which had been taken over, known as the Telch House, which was owned by a Jewish family, I think. It was, I think I mentioned, halfway up Mount Carmel. You've got a lovely view across, right down across the docks in Haifa and so forth. And it was reasonably cool being higher up. At that time when we arrived, it wasn't like Cairo at all. It was raining, it was cool, cold almost, with winds. It's almost like being in England again, but not so rough. But they definitely had a winter there. So I was lucky enough to be to have a room in Telch House itself. There were huts which had been built at the back to take all the syndicates. And a number of the DS staff and students who couldn't be got into the hotel were in houses which had been requisitioned down the road. We ate in, there was a main dining room in Telch House, the main large ballroom, I suppose it was, must have been originally, was turned into a sort of conference centre where there was chairs all round, and then you could have a model on the floor in the middle.
Cloth model, yes,
I'm sure it was. Too big for sand, I think, and anyway, it was inside. Anyway, it varied, I mean, according to what we went in there for. And as I said, the syndicate rooms were outside in the huts. When I got there, as I think I mentioned, who should I see but Geoffrey Elliott coming out with his red tabs up as full colonel. He also got a DSO, which he thoroughly deserved. But I'm sure he would be the first person to say that he also got it in recognition of the battalion's performance, 2nd Battalion, since it had been landed in Normandy up to the 1st of October. It had been pretty brilliant, actually. I mean, they don't think we'd done any withdrawals. In the end, we always got our objective one way or another, and we always managed to hold on to them. So I think they did pretty well. Anyway, he was in good form and welcomed me, to my surprise, to Telch House. The organisation, there was a brigadier in charge, who was the commandant. He was a Scotsman. I know because he wore a kilt. I think he was Gordon's. He was Brigadier Mac somebody, and I'm very sorry that I hope it wasn't MacDonald's, but it was Mac something. Anyway, he was the commandant. He was getting on a bit, as opposed to the others. I mean, at my young age, I looked upon him as being elderly. He got flecks of grey hair in his hair, in his head.
He would have been what?
So he must be old. Mm. Oh, I would imagine he must be in his 50s, I think. He then had a Colonel Coord, or Coordination, Colonel Good, who was from Light Infantry Regiment, I don't know which. Then the students were then split, and there were about 100 students, give or take one or two, split into two divisions. One division was headed by Geoffrey Elliott, who was the infantry representative, and then the other division was headed up by Colonel Cooper, who was cavalry, Royal Armour Corps, then his regiment. And naturally enough, I was in Cooper's. I couldn't be in Elliott's, obviously. And then each was split down into a number of syndicates, headed by a DS, a lieutenant colonel. Most of the lieutenant colonels were young, temporary lieutenant colonels for the job.
How many in a syndicate?
I was trying to think yesterday, I think about 8. There must have been 10 or more syndicates, I suppose.
In a division?
No, all together.
All together?
Yeah, because there was only 100,
yes.
100 students there. Mm. May have been just a few more, but not much. And then, of course, we each had a DS. And every so often, there was a complete reshuffle. I think there must have been at least three or four whilst I was there. Obviously, a DS had to have his same students there long enough to be able to pass judgment or to make an assessment of their capacity and capability. But at the same time, we didn't want that too long because they ought to be moved on so somebody else could have a look. And we only had 6 months. That made the course very intensive because, as you know, the peacetime course in Staff College was a year. But then you have to take account of the time they had off to go hunting, Ascot, what other things they did in peacetime.
Henley.
But I'm sure they work, we all know they work pretty hard anyway, even in peacetime. But this was a very intensive and almost, I don't care to use the word stressful because I think it's something which you're just under pressure more.
So it was on the syllabus. What were you studying in that 6 months?
Well, the object was to train people up to be able to qualify them to take grade 2 staff appointments. That is a major's appointment. And to develop them for higher command. That also came into it. That was the object. Well, now, we obviously, we studied everything. I mean, we started off by having lectures. And, of course, the DS were mixed. They came from every arm. We had them from Royal Artillery, Signals, Infantry, everything you could think of. We even had somebody there from Burma. And he was everybody's picture of somebody who'd been in Burma, poor chap. He even had malaria, and so we got all the lectures to start with, and we were issued with a file on it. So, for instance, we got a series of lectures on Royal Signals and signal communications, and I got a file with pages of diagrams.
Would these be comms diagrams showing radio net?
Yes, masses of them. Mm. I mean, we weren't just talking about battalions now, we were talking about divisions and corps and so forth. I don't think we were expected to learn it all, but it was there for reference. And this was done for every arm and every service, even, down to Army Corps, REME, everything, so that we then had... For instance, in the artillery, you got pages of how many rounds of ammunition a 25-pound needed to sustain it for so long, and how many 3-ton lorries would you need to get enough rounds up to the front to sustain a regiment or a agra or whatever. It got very, very complicated.
Sounds very detailed indeed.
Very detailed indeed. Well, you see, you had to imagine that you could take on any job afterwards. either at war office level, corps level, army level, brigade level. You had to be available or qualified to do any of those jobs and then after 2 years, be changed over again. We had lectures on the German army. Organization, identification, which I'd already had actually, identification, total organization, capabilities and so forth, US Army and the Japanese Army. And then in came the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force. In fact, we had a resident Air Commodore who was there to assist in exercises because we used to use the Air Force obviously a lot in exercises. They're figured in battles. And then we had outside lectures as well. I remember we had a well-known chap from the RAF who'd been, I think he was a fighter pilot, quite considerable renown. I can't remember his name now. He gave us the most amusing lecture. And then we had General Paget, who was Commander-in-Chief Middle East at that time, who came and talked to us. And we had all kinds of interesting lectures from outside our sort of general basis as well. So this went on for the first part of the course. In other words, they were feeding the information into us, or giving us the means of being able to look it up when the time came for exercises. And then they started off on the syndicate basis. We would first of all have discussions in syndicate on quite minor things, really.
What sort of things?
Well, I can't think of them now. Probably on what one would do in certain circumstances, quite low down on the level. It'd be set little exercises to do, and then they got bigger as time went by. And then the syndicates were split in halves, and each half was, each person in the half was designated as somebody. Somebody was in charge as the corps commander or divisional commander, not in the syndicates actually, it's probably more battalion commander. And he had under him the three other or four under chaps of the sub-committee, sub-syndicate. You would then had to go off into another room and do the exercise, write it out. It may be an operation order you had to produce. And the bloke who was planning commander had to delegate to the others what parts they would do. Some would do the bit where there was support, others administration, and the chap you didn't particularly trust did the distribution. That used to come up quite a bit. Well, not quite a bit, but now and again you found somebody in the syndicate that wasn't quite as bright as the others. So. Then you'd all go back and discuss it with the DS. Now, if it was something which went on for some time, and some of them did, you were working quite a long time on it, and you had a note to say this had to be in the DS box by 1 o'clock next morning. So you all worked on it, put it in the DS box. Then it would come back, green ink by the DS, and then red ink by the divisional top staff, top man, Cooper or Elliot. I don't remember anything actually going up to
the commandant.
I don't know what colour he used.
Probably violet,
yes. I think it had to be either extremely good or extremely bad for it to go up there. Certainly none of our mine went that way. So that went on for a bit, and then of course the syndicates were all changed around. Not only were the DS changed, but all the students were changed as well. So you had a different set of students with you next time, and a different DS. This gradually worked itself up to bigger exercises. We had a 36-hour exercise, I remember, which was all done on telephones.
Telephone? Would that be a telephone battle?
Yes, inside.
Inside.
For instance, we had a division. I think it was done on a divisional basis. You had the divisional commander and his staff in one room. Mm. Then you had the brigade commanders with their staffs in different rooms. Then the battalion commanders. And the divisional commander was first given the task, and he had to work it out, give out his orders and so forth, all the way down. Just as you got it going, suddenly somebody would arrive, pushed in by the DS, to say that something had happened, and the whole thing was turned on its head.
So there's a radical change.
It's a radical change in the situation, and this went on for the whole of six. We didn't get any sleep, we were up all night.
On that sort of exercise, was it an opposed exercise? In other words, did you have two syndicates in theory?
No, it was all, is everybody all in?
So the DS were generating the enemy then?
They were umpires, really, yes. Generating information.
Mm.
There weren't any enemy as such.
No.
The whole course was involved in this, not on the syndicate basis, but on a course basis. So that your divisional staff could be composed of anybody. Same with brigade staffs, battalions, headquarters and so forth. Then there were others who were used by the DS to do things, who didn't actually take part, I think. But the DS had a script, you see.
Yes.
Total script of what was going to happen, when it was going to happen. Mm. And once they'd issued the object of the exercise and what the divisional commander had to do, then the information was fed back from battalions and brigades to him, yes, of what the patrols had got, what information they had pushed back to him. Then would come information from Corps about air photographs that had been taken and what information was they'd gleaned from that. And then, of course, there'd be a huge counterattack somewhere and a gleeful DS would come in and say, which would upset the whole plan. So it was very, very well, very realistic and very, very well done, very well carried out.
Where was this battle set, this telephone battle? Was it set in the Middle East or was it set in Europe?
I just can't remember now. Mm. I think it was just in sort of no man's land. You know, the army has a habit of saying for this purposes the Mediterranean doesn't exist. Oh. Or whole of Europe is neutral. Mm. You know, they just put that on the side.
So it would be a mythical...
A mythical sort of... But it wouldn't be a desert. It wasn't a desert thing, I don't think. It was just a normal... It was really to practice battle procedures.
Yes.
See how people worked under some strain. And what proposals, what... proposals they came up with and what the result was, so that we were all marked as what we were doing on it and how we got on. The DS were running around with sort of flaps with boards and pencils and things, as they did most of the time. So that was 36 hours. Then we went out on toots. Mm. As well,
what sort of things were you practicing on toots?
Well, there was a defence attack. Mm. Usual things, defence attack, and I'm sure I must have done withdrawal as well. I remember the prime one, we used to go into Lebanon, of course, there was no problems there. We'd go across the border into Lebanon and do them there in those days. We were sitting on the banks, we'd been given an object of crossing a big river there which separates Palestine and Lebanon. Can't remember its name now.
The Litani River?
That's right. That's right. And we've been given the job of crossing this and mounting.
Is this to be an assault crossing?
Yes, assault crossing. And we were doing our recces, and we were told it was how deep and wide it was, and we could see that. And then we were doing our reconnaissance, and of course, in typical with toots, we weren't all lying behind hedges and things. We were all standing around in the open because what they wanted to know was what our results would be or what our proposals would be. And we were all sitting along the bank up a high cliff overlooking the river, wondering how we were going to get our bridging equipment up and get the assault boats up and get them across in this very deep river, you see. And as we were sitting there, an Arab with a donkey appeared on the other side and waded across, and the water didn't come any further up than his knees. When he got halfway up, we all looked and all started laughing. And everybody roared with laughter. This poor old Arab standing in the middle of the river there with his donkey looking up at us, wondering what the hell was going on. But those are the sort of things that happen. You were given situations and told that the river was deep when it really wasn't, or somewhere was much wider than it was and it really isn't. So you've got a more difficult hazard to overcome. But we used to go out in these toots, and again, it was usually on a syndicate basis, where you would be given a situation in a normal way of toots, as a battalion commander, usually as the battalion commander. And then we had to give out our orders verbally. This wasn't a paper thing inside. One person was chosen to give out the orders, and then the rest criticised. And then we took out haversack rations with us, which Mr. Telch manufactured for us, they were terrible.
What
in
was
fact,
wrong with them?
What?
What was wrong with them?
Well, there was nothing. I mean, the bread was usually stale, and what was in them you couldn't see with a magnifying glass. And they became known as Telch's Belches, or Telch Belch. But he got better because there were so many complaints. But eventually they got better and they became edible after a bit. But when we first started, I don't know what happened to the courses before, or whether, you know, they'd been all right and then they'd changed their complete, hadn't had enough money from British government or something, I don't know. Anyway, they were appalling. But we used to take these sandwiches out with us, mug or something, I suppose, as well, and stay out most of the day.
What do you think you learned on this course that you hadn't known before?
Hard work, for a start. Attention to detail. Organisation, total organisation of the British Army. Functions of other arms. Although I'd seen it, you see, on a low level.
I've seen it in action, haven't you?
But on a low level.
Yes.
I knew more about the German army than did probably about our own, because I, having been in doing intelligence work at Brigade and so forth, I'd been sent all the papers and things to read about it. But it also taught me how to work hard and attention, as I said, attention to detail. To be exact in what you do, to complete it to the end, or however you feel. And whatever you write has to be simple and short and understandable and unambiguous.
Because I got the impression that when you were in the field in Normandy, you didn't really go in for formal written orders to a great extent.
They used to come out sometimes. A lot of it was verbal. And if there was time, you see, there wasn't time for all the stuff. But very often you would get, not very often, but sometimes you would get written orders coming out, which would then say that they were unchanged from verbal orders at the top, so you didn't bother to read it. But if there were any changes afterwards, then they would be noted.
Yes.
But by and large, you see, they had to have, they had to go back to battalion rear battalion headquarters to get them turned off on the duplicator. It was too much of a fuss, really. And most of the attacks we did were fairly simple. We got to the stage where we knew what to do and what to bear in mind and who to look for in the way of FOOs or sappers or whatever. And they became unnecessary. It's really when you get back to brigade and formation headquarters that written orders were necessary. And that was another thing, of course. Well, as I've implied, clear, very clear, written orders in a certain way.
And format.
Format was laid out both for operation orders and for reviews, which you had to do, appreciation of the situation, which you had to, we all had to do an appreciation of the situation. Mm-hmm. And then the order. And even went down to making sure that every, you know, when I made fun of the distribution list, but it was very important. You left somebody off, you left the gunners off or something, and then you wondered why you didn't get any artillery support, simply because they didn't get the order. So it was very important, even that.
Also for the historian.
And historians, yes. War diary it went to, yes.
Yes.
That's right. I think those were the main things. Everything else stemmed from, if you pick those up. I think loyalty, well, that's imbued in most of us already anyway.
But basic military virtue.
Yes, exactly, yes. I don't think that was necessarily needed to be...
Certainly not something
new. No, there's nothing new about that. If you haven't got loyalty, you won't, shouldn't be there. I think the other thing was to be able to speak up and make a case if there was a discussion going on about what...